progressive ideas, conversations from schools, and the newest concepts in education. This is the School Leadership Podcast.
The evidence is stark. Stress and burnout are rising, anxiety and depression are on the increase. Well-being in the teaching profession is perhaps at its lowest ebb. The conversation you're about to hear is in parts a coruscating commentary on the present state of affairs and comes from one of the leading authorities on the subject. Sinead McBriarty is the Chief Executive of Education Support, with an ethos that's firmly rooted in the notion that better mental health leads to better education. It's an organisation that comprehensively researches the mental health and well-being of teachers and all education staff and supports accordingly. Sinead is with the NAHT's Assistant General Secretary, James Bowen, who's about to go further into issues like isolation in school leaders and, of course, Ofsted. And please be aware that the following conversation includes references to suicide, and further information about where you can access help and support is contained at the end of this episode.
So Sinead, thank you for joining us again on NHT's podcast. It's good to have you back as a guest. This is now, I think, the seventh wellbeing index you've done, if I've counted correctly. And for those who haven't heard about it before, can you tell us what the idea is behind it, why you do it annually, what you're trying to achieve with it?
Well, first of all, I need to take the moment to just revel in the fact that you've counted seven, James. That's deeply pleasing. But the Teacher Wellbeing Index, we started producing Education Support as a small charity. And we realized that our resources are not going to reach across the sector to support everybody who is dealing with mental health issues, with stress issues, with workload issues. And so in thinking about how we might be able to have a bigger impact, we thought we need to shine a light on what's happening in the profession. And it's under-researched. The health and well-being of the profession is under-researched. So we thought, well, if we can produce this annual benchmark, we can start to focus the conversation around some good data that is primary data, looking at exactly what's going on for educators across the UK. And we'll be able to flag emerging issues. We'll be able to highlight trends over time, but we'll also be able to use that survey process to inquire about particular things that feel relevant in the moment. So, for example, around COVID, we were able to ask some really timely questions around the experience of staff in schools and the impact of the pandemic on professional wellbeing. So that's what it's there for. It is there to kind of make sure we've got good data and we're not just hypothesizing or using anecdotes to tell the story of what's going on in education currently.
And as always, there's just so much data in there. I looked at the report again yesterday and you've got huge amounts of data in there. But what would you sort of say the headlines are for this year? And I suppose what I'm really interested in, how has that changed? How are we seeing changes from last year over time? What's the data doing?
In a headline terms, it's not a jolly picture, but well-being for education staff is at its lowest level since we began measuring it with the Validated Warwick Edinburgh measurement of well-being. We are seeing stress and burnout rising. We see anxiety and depression and exhaustion all fairly plateaued, but unfortunately plateaued at high levels. So when we look at those kind of key indicators of the mental health of the profession, none of them are positive. None of them are heading in the right direction. And in addition to that, when we look around the corners, if you like, we've seen a massive increase in the proportion of staff, including leaders, who experience the culture of their school or organisation or MAT as having a negative impact on their well-being. And this has spiked dramatically this year. You know, in the round, it's a pretty grim picture. Maybe the one spot where there's been some improvement is in the proportion of educators who feel like their employer is supporting them if they have a mental health or well-being issues. And that is positive. That's improved a little bit over time. It's not dramatic. It's not as big as we'd want to see it, but there is some improvement there. So those are the kind of indicators that we look at year on year, James. We also have looked at some other stuff this year, which I think we'll talk about in more detail as we go through. Every year we try and take a different issue to inquire a bit more deeply on. And this year we looked at inspections and also loneliness in the profession. But as far as those wider mental health pictures go, it's fairly plateaued, edging up incrementally or plateaued, but really at an unsustainably high level and a concerning level. And again, I find myself writing in the foreword of these Teacher Wellbeing Index publications each year and saying, you know, we've got a very significant problem. There's a, you know, the red flashing light on the well-being of the profession. And again, for the last few years, I've been trying to highlight that school leaders' well-being in particular is really concerningly not okay.
And I certainly want to come back to some of those issues around isolation, Ofsted and others. I suppose that there is a question to ask first, really, which in to what extent is this unique to the teaching profession and school leadership? I guess what I'm thinking is there probably, yeah, we know there's lots of professions where stress and burnout is a feature of the role, but is there something unique going on in our profession here in terms of the levels of stress and burnout compared to most other professions?
The unique question is an interesting one, and we'll just come back to that in a minute. But the in terms of the relativity to other sectors, you know, we've seen, particularly post-pandemic, we've seen burnout, I think, creep up across a variety of industries, stress levels also being higher. But when we think about education, I think the most important kind of context to compare it to is the wider public sector. And a key indicator that we look at in terms of the overall well-being of the workforce is attrition. Now, if you compare us in that case to social care, I think social care is really shocking. We've got 150,000 vacancies in social care currently. It really is not in a good shape. But the health and safety executive, who each year assess the level of stress in the sector, and they do that, they look at self-reported work-related ill health to do that. Teaching is always in the top three. And again, this year in the stats just released, it's in the top three. So I think we see a public sector that is under significant pressure. Within that, teaching education continues to be very high relative to other professions for stress. And for attrition, as we know. But what's unique in education? Well, we could talk about a few things, but I think the point I would want to land is the obvious one to people listening to this podcast, is education matters so very much because of the interface with children and young people. If we imagine that a system that is under the levels of stress that this workforce is, if we imagine we can contain that level of stress and it not impact children and young people, we'd be deluding ourselves. And so I think it is, for me, critically important because we're talking about every child in the country coming into contact with the education system. This matters enormously for the future of England and the United Kingdom. And some of the stuff that goes into it, what's different in education? Well, I think it goes back to the interface with children and young people. Here we are post-pandemic. There's been this massive once in a generation event that has taken its toll. Before that, the statistics on stress and so on were pretty dreadful. But in the aftermath of that, it's ratcheted up very significantly. The level of need that we see in our communities across the country is far in excess of the capacity that exists in schools to meet those needs. And I think that's a deeply uncomfortable place for professionals. And they either try and work themselves into the ground to fix it as though they could somehow compensate for all that's missing more broadly for our children and young people and families, or they become demoralized because they just think, how on earth can I make a difference when these kids aren't fed, when they're turning up to school and they clearly aren't safe at home and there is no timeline on when they will be safe. I don't know when I can, you know, relax and know that they're being looked after, or we have children who can't access the kind of mental health support that they need, or a variety of other issues. But again, it is, I think, one of the things that's unique is that our workforce is interacting with children and young people at a time when they have more need than they've had in living memory.
Things have got worse between 2022, 2023, and probably worse from 2021 as well. And there's part of me thinking, well, you know, we're out of the worst of the pandemic in the last 12 months. You know, I don't, I hate to say it's over because we know we're still feeling the consequences. But what is it? Do you have any sense of what the factors are that have driven the kind of the further fall in terms of people's well-being? Is it that sense of I can't do the job I want to do because I haven't got the resources, and that in itself drives stress? Are there other things going on? Did teachers talk to you and leaders talk to you about why things have got worse in the last 12, 24 months?
I've sat in on a lot of focus groups over the last 12 months talking to educators, not asking them about why is it so awful, but listening to them describe their experience. And I think what I've taken from that is less is not more. It is really difficult to do the job that is being asked of our teachers when the resources aren't there. And resources in terms of, you know, there are fewer adults, there are fewer specialists, there is less money, fewer resources to use, fewer outings, fewer ways to make the school day, the school week, the school year exciting and interesting. You know, those high points that people look forward to are peeled out. And so I think that erosion of resources is pretty high on the list that affects people. What we were saying about COVID is relevant. I think this year has happened in the aftermath of some really exhausting years. And you can't keep going without, you know, in the face of feeling really exhausted, you can't just keep going and produce more and more. So if you come out of austerity, gone into COVID, come out of COVID and gone into what feels like more austerity, cost of living crisis, all of the issues that come along with that, people haven't had the chance to recover. And that underlying bed of exhaustion is real. And I think affects people differently, but it's definitely affected a lot of people. And I think beyond that, you know, industrial action, whilst people have felt very impassioned about their right and the need to stand up for the resourcing of the education sector, it's also difficult for people. It doesn't sit comfortably with professionals to think, I'm not there, I'm not turning up, and, you know, this is going to have a knock-on impact on the community. So I think we've certainly heard people describe that behaviour, children and young people's behaviour, in two dimensions. One, you know, problematic behaviour seems to be more frequent, more common, more difficult to deal with at every age, from very young ages in primary. Now we're seeing some complicated behaviour, but also the way in which children behave when they are not okay, which isn't to say they're being, in inverted commas, naughty, but there are things that they are facing that are difficult, and the way in which that affects how they show up at school can either mean that it is difficult to attend to them because they need more attention than is available. It can mean that some of the behaviours that they bring in are problematic for other kids in the classroom, and trying to work out how to address that is its own issue. But also teachers, and we see this more getting into the secondary settings, but teachers have been describing this great sense of apathy that really disturbs them, particularly in less well-resourced areas. I heard over and over again, none of this was prompted, but teachers describing this phenomenon of pupils in secondary school going up to and including in GCSE years, just not caring or appearing to care and not wanting to engage. And so that's been quite concerning, that sort of disconnection that we see in our young people. And I think the last thing I'd raise in that context is I wouldn't underestimate the impact of the groundswell of feeling around Ruth Perry's death, and the way in which Ofsted responded to that and was seen to kind of miss the point in lots of ways. I think it's created a lot of anger and frustration. And that's part of the backdrop of professionals not feeling valued, not feeling seen, not feeling that their professional identity is recognised more broadly in the sector.
And I suppose that leads us into the section of the report, which you mentioned right at the beginning, which I don't think you've done before, where you have a particular focus on Ofsted. And it was interesting this year you decided to do that. I assume that was in light of, partly in light of the events of the last 12 months, but also, you know, what you're hearing from the profession. So what was it that made you think to include Ofsted specifically this year? And what were teachers and school leaders telling you about Ofsted and the impact on wellbeing?
So the reason to do it this year is very much around Ruth Perry's passing and feeling that, you know, her death was avoidable. I run a charity that exists to support the mental health and well-being of everyone working in the profession. And I recognise that we can't do that across the piece. We can't reach everybody. But I also think it's incumbent on us to do everything that we can do to ensure that the issues that need to be addressed are addressed. And so asking this question is partly an effort to create an evidence base from a well-being perspective around what is the actual experience on Ofsted. And we did that comparatively across the four nations, and it was pretty interesting to see the outcome of it. And England really has a more complicated relationship with inspection than the other nations. To be clear, none of the four nations are loving inspections. But there is, for example, more faith in the judgments and so on in Northern Ireland than in England. And different nations did better on certain scores, but England did, across the whole set of questions, didn't perform very well. So what are professionals saying? Almost three quarters would say that inspections are not fit for purpose. Almost three quarters feel that they don't improve learner achievement. You know, two-thirds of the profession feel that inspections negatively impact staff mental health and well-being. So that's pretty chunky, 71% saying that. And I guess the overall picture behind that is the rest of the questions that we asked. Professionals don't think that the inspection's producing especially useful information. They don't think that it's taking into account the actual context that a school or a college is sitting in, so and levels of deprivation, for example. And they don't think that there is a comprehensive picture of the strengths and weaknesses of a school or college presented in an inspection report. Pretty much two-thirds feel that the inspections don't deliver reliable judgments. So I guess we add this into the evidence base because we want to just be clear that this is the voice of the profession in a wholly anonymous way, being asked for their point of view, not at a point where they're, you know, they're not necessarily in inspection at that point in time, but just generally thinking about it. And that's what we heard back. We are going to do some focus groups around this data over the next few months. And indeed, I might come back to NAHT and ask you to, you know, let your members know and if people want to participate, because I think it's really important to get under the bonnet of some of that. But it's an important time for us to look at and I think time for some real root and branch reviews of how inspection is done and ensuring that the voice of the profession is involved in that, is central to that. And, you know, you've heard me say before, I would love to see the profession co-creating the future of inspection with the regulator and other stakeholders, with parents. You know, I think we live in 2023. I think that sort of co-creation model is not radical and it's not unreliable. So I think it's time for us to modernise a little bit how we do these things.
I think our members would be very keen to be involved and to speak to you about their experiences and ideas. I mean, I should say, shouldn't I, that we're recording this, what, 3 or 4 days after we saw the coroner's findings from the Ruth Perry's case. So this is all obviously incredibly, incredibly live, as it has been throughout the year, but particularly at the moment, I think, and probably people will be listening to this within a week of those findings. So obviously it's very, very high up in people's minds.
And I'd just add on that, James, that the actual fieldwork for this research, so the findings that we're looking at, the fieldwork was done in June, July of 2023. So not while this was kind of in the heat of the media's glare so much. So just for context, you know, we put these questions out into the fieldwork in the spring and the actual questions were asked in June, July. So.
And that does remind me, and you know, I guess we're both on the tread very carefully here in terms of discussion, but there was a part in your report where you talk about, and I've never seen this before, kind of talk around professional isolation, I think you called it, or in sort of perhaps elsewhere sort of referred to frankly as loneliness, perhaps more, you know, in simple terms. Could you tell us a bit more about that section and what the findings were around that?
Absolutely. So again, this comes with us deciding that we wanted to reflect on what could we learn from Ruth Perry's death. What could we bring into the evidence base that would be useful perhaps for different stakeholders to attend to and pay attention to? And we decided to ask some questions around professional loneliness because isolation and loneliness are really relevant when it comes to suicide risk. So the higher the level of isolation and loneliness, the more at risk someone is for severe mental health issues across a range of outcomes, but also in reflecting on suicide risk, isolation is really important. And what we mean by professional isolation is pretty much what you've said. You know, it's when people feel cut off, when they don't feel supported, they don't feel part of a community at work. They're basically not feeling connected socially and emotionally to their their work colleagues to the place where they work, and very much on their own. And the findings were, to be honest, the findings surprised me. We found that the rate of loneliness in the education profession is running at almost twice the rate of the general population. So whilst it doesn't sound so high if I say, you know, 17% of staff are feeling isolated, often or always, that's twice the rate of the general population. And that's what makes it significant. I think it's important to highlight as well what one of the other points that came through when we looked at isolation was we're seeing particularly high levels of isolation, like three times the general population rate, experienced by staff who are from a global majority background. So I think this adds again to what we already know, that we have colleagues, black and brown colleagues, who are feeling marginalized, who feel disconnected from the communities they work in. And this data, I think, evidences again that, you know, when it comes to equality, diversity and inclusion strategies, we're not getting the inclusion right, because those levels of isolation are unacceptably high in our global majority background colleagues.
These just feel like such incredibly important findings, and perhaps kind of, although we've talked about well-being in the past, I don't think we've really ever talked about this issue perhaps quite so much, you know, professional isolation, loneliness. They're certainly not words I've come across in the past when we've been talking about sort of well-being. And is it fair to say, I mean, I'm speculating here, but I'm guessing school leaders could be particularly vulnerable to this. You know, often school leaders will talk about it being quite a lonely job. You know, I've heard that phrase often. I think I used that phrase as a school leader, where, particularly in a small school, where you may not necessarily have a particularly large team, you may not even have a deputy, and you can feel quite isolated and alone as so, for example, the head teacher in a school or another senior leadership position. And as you said, obviously, this can affect all professionals in a school. So it's certainly not unique to school leaders. But is there something there about school leaders being particularly vulnerable to this, do you think?
We were very cautious in the report about commenting on this. And we commented in a quite contained way about identifying specific cohorts who are particularly at risk. And I think we made sure those the terms on which we defined risk were really belt and braces. I think we could loosen that. And I actually think a much higher proportion of people are at risk than we've published in this report. But I don't want to, as you can imagine, I'm not wanting to sensationalize that. And so I wanted to be very cautious. But yeah, when we looked at the proportion of the workforce who are experiencing loneliness as well as acute stress or burnout, because those combinations of things coming together are, I think, problematic. We found that was affecting 5% of all staff, but 6% of leaders. So a higher proportion of leaders. And whilst that's only 1%, actually it's 20% more than the full population. So it is material. I think this is an area that we at Education Support are very thoughtful around, how we look at this more closely, what we can usefully bring into play, but that is why we've made, for the first time since I've been, it's almost 5 years that I've been chief executive here, and this is the first year that we've called for a prioritization of suicide prevention. I think suicide prevention is one element, but also this real need to attend to a proper well-being strategy, workforce well-being strategy. And you and I will have talked in the past, you know, certainly when I came into this role, well-being was conflated with workload in the policymaker's mind, very understandably. But we know when we've pulled it apart and disaggregated it, it's a lot more than that. There's different elements to it. We do need to have a coherent strategy that's going to address the well-being of the professional. But as well as that, I think we do need some work around suicide awareness, because I think, frankly, we have colleagues who are significantly at risk. And I know this because our helpline deals with hundreds of them. And it's not unusual when I'm out and about chatting to folks in education, it's not unusual that I'm talking to people who are in significant distress and really at risk. So I think it's time for us to articulate that, be public about that, and begin to take appropriate steps to make sure that we can make the workforce as safe as possible.
I'm just thinking, Sinead, given the conversation we're having right now, it's probably only right that we should remind people who are listening about sources of support at this point. And I know if they go to the NHT website, there's the link through there to our education support phone line, which we work in partnership with you on. If they were to go to the education support website, they would find the same. Just worth flagging those. You know, there are people out there ready to help and support professionals, and feels appropriate just to flag that at this point, I think.
Absolutely, and I'll just give the free phone number that is anyone in any role, from the caretaker, anyone anywhere in any role in the school, is welcome to contact our counselling team on the free phone number, which is 08000 562 561, and we have qualified counsellors on the end of the phone. The clinical evaluation of the service there is outstanding. You will be, whoever phones that number will be well supported and validated by colleagues, and it's a good place to start if you're not sure where else to turn. But also, if you're not in absolute distress, actually, if you've got somebody in the school who's just not themselves, I think it's really important to encourage people to talk. And this helpline is confidential, 24/7, free. And it is for everyone working in education, so please use it.
Thanks, Sinead. We should probably talk a bit about solutions as well, you know, in terms of, I know your report makes lots of recommendations at the end, and I suspect you must get frustrated because the recommendations some years are probably very similar to previous years. But when we are talking about solutions, what would you like to see happen? I mean, I know you kind of referred to some things already in terms of actually schools having the resources they need to do the job and what have you, but what needs to happen if we're going to start seeing that wellbeing index shift in the right direction?
Well, this is my 8-point plan, James. I'm so glad you asked this question. I think we can talk about this. There's recommendations in the wellbeing index, and we put a lot of time and thought into those. We didn't just throw them down. We think they're things that really will make a difference, whether that's in terms of a wider strategy, overhauling the inspection system, the wider funding in education, and so on. But I think when I think about well-being and where we are with it, I think that there are, you know, some headline items that we need to get right in the sector. So workload is clearly one of them. Work-life balance is adjacent to that, but it's not the same. And that's something that we probably can think about at a school level. But when people so obviously if workload is high, your work-life balance is probably not great. But that's not always a kind of linear line between volume of hours, you know, number of hours worked and experience of work-life balance. But the issue is when people can't switch off, when they are never kind of restored, when work has a significant impact on their personal well-being, is creating stress, that's very problematic. And we know that from global research. That's kind of pretty much the most difficult thing. People's performance will decrease, their personal well-being decreases, their health deteriorates. It's really not a good place to be. So getting work-life balance right is really important for the sector, actually. And it's not about having yoga lessons on Friday. Nothing wrong with yoga lessons, but this is about people being able to live their lives. You know, I've had too many conversations with people who say, I can't be a parent and a teacher. That can't be right. And we have to get that right. So that's workload, work-life balance. I think culture is hugely important, might be one for us to come back and have another conversation about. But too many people, including leaders, are experiencing the culture in school as negative for their well-being. I think there's something here about compliance cultures, about working in a high demand environment when you feel you've got low control. But there's a shift we need to get to there, which is also around actually the status of the profession. I think that's part of the culture question. Accountability. I annoy my colleagues because they would like me to say something pithy and straightforward on this. But I think one of the things that I think is really important to get right is the variability of inspection. If we don't have a kind of a commonality, and you can't have an agreed level from every inspector, basically one inspector who is unkind and unfair creates the culture of inspection. So that variability has to be corrected, but also subjectivity. Our current inspection system has a high degree of subjectivity. And that means you're always going to have the possibility of a wide variety of outcomes. And until we think again, I think about that and how we take the good from what we've got, but we cannot sustain this wide subjectivity in the process while trust in the regulator is as low as it is. So accountability, we need to review. Leader burnout. We can't afford nationally to lose the number of leaders that we lose. It takes too long to become good at education for us to just replace people quickly. And if we continue to cannibalize our middle leadership by dragging them up before they're ready into school leadership, we are only going to perpetuate, deepen and deepen this problem, and it will be harder and harder to fix. So I think this goes back to the culture question, because I think we pay, I mean, obviously, let me be really clear, heads should be paid more. I'm sitting here looking at James Bowen from the NAHT. Of course, I'm going to be very clear about that. But relatively, I don't think pay is what's, you know, that's burnout is a different thing. It's a, it might be adjacent to it, but we have got to make this job doable. And it isn't currently for too many people. And then the last couple, you know, children and young people's needs are under-resourced. This is a national issue. We have got a generation of children and young people who've gone through a tremendous thing. And we don't live in the 1940s or the 1950s. It's not good enough to say, pull yourself together, stiff upper lip and on you go. That's not going to work. The pressures that exist in 2023 are very different, but also the support systems are very different. We don't all live next door to our aunties and uncles and the wider family infrastructure that we used to. We're not held in a community of loving, supportive adults by and large. We live in quite an atomized way. So, you know, I really resist narratives that blame young people for not sorting themselves out better. I think we have created the culture we've created, but we need to support people to live and thrive in it. And poverty is really then the huge bit around that. It is shameful to me, as a proud British citizen, obviously a dual citizen, it is shameful to me that we had 1 million children experience destitution last year. I cannot get my head around how that is possible in this country in this day and age. And that is a massive issue for schools, poverty in schools, the impact of poverty on children going to schools, on readiness to learn. It's huge. And it is not yet, it seems to me, the national crisis. How it's not dominating the front pages is beyond me. I have to stop talking, James, because I'm going to say things I'll regret.
I'm going to stay quiet and allow you to carry on. I mean, there is just so much more in there we could unpack. I mean, this whole thing about we are so digitally connected now, but sort of socially disconnected, and the implications of that. And I'd love to talk to you more as well about sort of school culture and what have you. But we are rapidly running out of time, so I'm going to have to get you back for another podcast. I suppose to finish, what I was going to ask you, and you did sort of touch on this at the beginning. I mean, obviously, there's an awful lot of findings in this report which are quite bleak and going to be worrying. Are there any silver linings? Are there any reasons to be hopeful? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning about schools are getting better somewhat at understanding well-being and supporting staff with their well-being. Is that the glimmer of hope we're hanging on to? I'm looking for, is there positivity buried within the kind of data that we can hold on to?
I am positive. For all that I come on here and drown you in my miserable data and stories, I am actually fundamentally very positive. I think that we are living through a culture change on the ground, actually. I think when I came and talked to you and colleagues in 2019, well-being was still a little bit marginal, you know, and NAHT was quite radical having this well-being conversation on the agenda. But look at where we are now. It's like front and center of so much of the conversation. And that matters. I think the place where it matters the most is in our communities of schools and among school leaders, because as each school leader looks at this differently, re-looks at it, changes their beliefs, feels like it's something to engage with, that's where we get the groundswell of change. You know, I will happily bang my head on brick walls to try and get policy to change, but actually, I believe real change happens in the communities of practice on the ground. And so that shift is happening. I think the focus and attention of professionals on the ground is different. And that will drive culture change. That is driving culture change. We're not at all there, but we are moving toward a place where it's now not unacceptable for me to say that to privilege performance in our education system over well-being is not wise. And I can say that and feel like I can stand up and sensible people will nod and think, actually, okay, yeah, I see that. And partly it's because the evidence base is improving. We've got better evidence to demonstrate why well-being actually matters. And if we can look after the well-being of children, young people and the staff serving them, we're going to be in a much better place to then look at, make sure that we support the best performance we can get to. But if we drive performance without attending to well-being, we might get a short-term return, but that is not sustainable over time, full stop, and that's the hill I'll die on. I think the last thing that makes me optimistic is the dynamics of the workforce. Those dynamics are heading in one way, and it is unavoidable. We have got to make change if we want a workforce in schools and colleges in 5 and 10 years' time, and everybody recognizes that. So I think that simply requires change. And so while some people may not come to that conversation of change with the most open of hearts, they still have to come. Nobody can ignore this now.
And Sinead McBrearty was talking to James Bowen there. And as Sinead said, the Education Support Helpline number is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's 08000 562 561. That's a free phone number, 08000 562 561, where qualified personnel can talk through any of the issues discussed in the conversation you've just heard. Our thanks to you for listening to the School Leadership Podcast. Subscribing in any of the major podcast apps is the most effective way to ensure new episodes are flagged up and ready to play. And when you have some time to leave a review, some feedback for the podcast, we will be extremely grateful. NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT member, go online to naht.org.uk/join. naht.org.uk/join. And on X, formerly known as Twitter, we're at NAHT News. We're back in 2024, so in the meantime, look after yourself, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Take care.
For regular and useful content on the teaching profession, it has to be the School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.